and Henry would later call himself having spent all of his life from childhood as a prisoner of others, which I think says a lot about the man when he becomes king, that he would never do anyone's bidding. We know that Christmas Day 1483, he himself pledges to be the rightful king of England. The Tudor name comes in just through simple mistake. Henry, correctly, should be Harry ap Edmund ap Owain. Harry, the son of Edmund, the son of Owain.
I'm actually really fascinated by Owen Tudor, the uncle. If he's at Westminster Abbey, then he was there during Elizabeth Woodville's sanctuary.
I had never thought of that. Maybe we've got a new conspirator. Oh, I've got goosebumps.
Hello and welcome to the British History Channel with me, Philippa Lacey Brule, and to our latest historian interview. Today I am talking to Nathan Armin about Henry Tudor and the ongoing discussion on whether Richard III's nephews actually survived. If you have been here before, thank you for coming back. And if this is your first time, then thank you for checking out the channel. If you love British history, then you are definitely in the right place. And not only have I got a great interview for you today, but you can also browse another 35 other historian interviews that have happened prior to this one. And maybe by the time you watch this one, there'll be even more to check out. There's also lots more history videos. Each week I do a live history tea time chat, or tea time history chat live, depending on how I call it, but you get the idea. And we talk about a different topic each week. They are all in the back catalogue on the channel for you to see under the live tab. And you can join me live each Wednesday at 3 p.m. I stream live on YouTube, Instagram and Facebook. But anyway, today, Nathan Armin is who I am talking to. He is a historian and author from Carmarthenshire in Wales. His focus is on the 15th century and the reign of Henry VII. He wrote Tudor Wales in 2014, and as a bit of a diversion, but one I thoroughly approve of, York Pubs in 2016, followed by the first full-length biography of the Beaufort family called The House of Beaufort, published in 2017. His fourth book, which I have here, is Henry VII and the Tudor Pretenders, Simnel, Warbeck and Warwick, and that was released in 2021. And this July, Nathan's fifth long-awaited biography of Henry VII will be out. You may recognise Nathan from TV, most recently taking part in The Princes in the Tower, The New Evidence documentary, in which Nathan was a questioning voice to the claims made that Richard III never had his nephews murdered. And in fact, the Pretenders, the topic of Nathan's fourth book, of course, were actually the princes in the tower, each coming back in turn to try and win back the crown from the usurper Henry Tudor. I'm very happy to say that Nathan will be joining the Rise of the Tudors tour from British History Tours this September as a guest speaker, and my guests are already looking forward to meeting him in person very much. As usual, members of my British History Patreon Club have submitted their own questions, which I will put to Nathan after the main interview, and that section, that extra section, will make up the extended ad-free version of this episode, which members of my Patreon can access. And if you're not already a patron, please do check out the details at www.patreon.com/British History. There is lots in there that I think you will enjoy, including book club and, of course, the opportunity to put your questions to my future or my guests in the future. So for now, though, let's get on with our interview. Nathan, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to this. So I have given people a little bit of an idea about you already, but can you explain a little bit about yourself and your work, please?
Yeah, I'm an author and historian from West Wales, which everyone can probably instantly tell from my accent. I focus on the study of Henry VII. In particular, his Welsh background. I always feel that his Welsh background has been diminished and disregarded, so I have tried to bring that out of the shadows somewhat. In the past, I've done some work on the House of Beaufort, and and Henry VII and the Tudor pretenders. So very much, I think, known and comfortable in the 15th century, probably more so than the 21st century, shall we say.
I think quite a few people would agree with you at the moment. There's quite a few people going, I think I should have been born in a different era. This one's a little uncomfortable. I'm sure they all had their downsides. That's good. I definitely want to get into the Welsh element with you today, and with, you know, the links to Henry VII, most definitely. So we will chat about your new book that you've got coming out in July, which is a biography, I believe, of Henry VII. Can't wait to read that. But yes, let's start off then with Henry's relationship to Wales. How Welsh was Henry Tudor?
I mean, I think Henry Tudor was very Welsh. It's obviously a very difficult question to answer, because the same as today, you know, how Welsh or how English is somebody and so on. It can be quite a loaded question in the modern age. And certainly when we discuss Henry Tudor, depending on someone's modern views of Wales and its place in the Union, some people will seek to diminish Henry Tudor's Welshness. A modern Welsh person might think Henry Tudor didn't do much for Wales, therefore he wasn't Welsh. Certainly in English historical circles, they've sought to diminish his Welshness. Oh, Henry Tudor was actually only a quarter Welsh by blood. He was a quarter French and half English, therefore he clearly is English. I think if we were to ask Henry Tudor himself, he would definitely view himself as what we would call a Cymro, a Welshman. And there's good evidence for this. Henry was born in Wales, first and foremost. And it's not true, as has often been believed, that he left Wales as a child. He didn't leave Wales till he was 14 years old. So that's 14 years he was born and raised in Wales. He certainly had very good Welsh lineage through his father's side. As we all know, during this period in question, it is always the father's lineage that matters. Rightly or wrongly, it is simply that paternal line that, you know, gives families their credibility, it gives them their wealth, it gives them their inheritance. Henry, through his family, could trace his ancestors back at least to the 1100s that we know in Wales, to a chap called Ednyfed Vychan, who is a very prominent North Welshman. And from Ednyfed, we can trace it back to the great Welsh kings, such as Hywel Dda, Rhodri Mawr, and all these wonderful Welsh leaders who were around long before the Norman Conquest. When Henry becomes king himself, he adopts as his badge the Red Dragon of Cadwallader. Cadwallader was a Welsh king from the 6th century, and Henry, you know, very consciously chooses this badge as his own badge. You know, he's making a statement. I am a Welshman. My lineage is long before the Plantagenets and the Normans have come along. I am from these islands. And as I say, Henry was raised in Wales until he was 14 years old. And then he crossed over to Brittany. Brittany then was a country very similar to Wales, ethnically, culturally, linguistically. People always consider today that Wales, Ireland, and Scotland are the Celtic nations. In actual reality, the countries that had a connection back then was Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany. Ireland and Scotland are a different beast altogether to Wales, you know, again, ethnically, culturally, and historically. So when Henry moved to Brittany for the next 12 years, he's in a land where the language is very similar to Welsh. The people are very similar to Welsh. I think this just reinforces his sense of Welshness. He certainly never knew England until he became king. Until he was 28 years old, that's the first concrete evidence we have of him really spending any time in England. And again, there's myriad of evidence to suggest he was personally taken with Wales. We know that he names his son Arthur. We know that he has a love for Welsh mead. And we know that he liked to surround himself with Welshmen. So I think if we ask the question to Henry, Henry would have said he's very Welsh. He would have supported Wales in the rugby. Let's put it that way.
I get you. Right. So his lineage on his father's side sounds quite solid in terms of, you know, the rank even, which is, that's hardly ever spoken about. It's almost like his father actually is a bit of a side story, because Margaret Beaufort is, obviously a John of Gaunt descendant and a formidable woman in her own right. And actually, I think his father does become a bit of a side story, obviously dying before he's even born as well. So that's really interesting. So, and also, it's not a French influence that he gets when he goes to Brittany then, from what you say.
There certainly is a French effect to Henry Tudor in that when he does become King of England, it is said that he does speak perhaps more in the French manner, and he certainly would like to rule England in the French manner. You know, that drew him some criticism. Because again, he hadn't been raised in England. He hadn't been raised running English lands or English estates. He had been raised in Wales by a Welshman for 14 years, and then he crossed over to Brittany. Now, Brittany was and is still a French-speaking area, but it also has its own historic language of Breton. You know, similar as we could say to Wales, Brittany and Wales, even today, share many similarities. And that's why there's still quite a lot of cultural crossover between the two nations. So he certainly was more French than he was English, but I would argue, arguably, he was more Welsh than either. But that has always been written out and diminished in the story of Henry Tudor. With my Welsh hat on, I have various reasons for that. I think in Wales, the Tudor's reputation has become a bit dirtied by Wales's modern economic and political wars. A lot of people pin the blame on Wales's current issues on the Tudors, I think quite unfairly. Just as an example, people view the Welsh language to be a dying language, and they pin the blame on Henry VIII because when he brought in an act in 1536 that basically annexed Wales into England, it made Wales a formal part of England. One of the stipulations was that all order of business must be done in the English tongue. So essentially cancelling Welsh. So modern Welsh people view the reason the Welsh is struggling these days is because of the Tudors. And it's simply not true, because we have censuses in this country. We know up to 1901, Wales was almost a completely Welsh-speaking nation. So if Welsh survived for 400 years after the Tudors, it can't be the Tudors' fault that they cancelled it. So we have an issue with the Tudors' reputation within Wales today, but also in English historical circles. I just think if you read any Victorian text, if you study anything about the Victorians, you know how much they look down and diminished and disregarded the Welsh. You know, they couldn't have their greatest dynasty having been formed by a Welshman. A lot of it has been removed by our esteemed Oxbridge predecessors. And the Welsh would always view that. Certainly during the 14th and 15th century, there was epic rivalries between the English and the Welsh. But they certainly were, I think, respected. And I think Henry's lineage and the old blood of these islands were something that would have drawn respect, enough respect for a king of England to keep on drawing references to it.
Now, Tudor is a very shortened version of their surname, isn't it? I believe.
It is, yes. So Tudor, or in Welsh, Tudur, is a Welsh given name. Now, Wales always had patronymics. So, you know, we didn't have surnames, similar to what Iceland and, you know, parts of Scandinavia still do today. So for example, if we take the first Welsh Tudor who moved to England, that was Owen Tudor. Everybody loves Owen Tudor. Owen Tudor was famously that Welsh squire who, through sheer Welsh charm, managed to capture the affections of a French princess and a former Queen of England in Catherine of Valois. Owen moves to England. His name is Owain ap Meredith ap Tudur. And that is Owen, son of Meredith, son of Tudor. Now, when he starts to get notice in England, the English clerks, they don't understand this. What is Owain ap Meredith ap Tudur? All they see is at the start, Owain, at the end, Tudur. So they start calling him Owen Tudor. Now, we do have various other references to him being called Owen Meredith, Owen Fitz Tudor, Owen Fitz Meredith. Like, they completely butcher his name. But certainly by the time Henry Tudor is born, he is regarded as Owen Tudor. His son, similarly, is Jasper Tudor. More properly, Jasper should actually be Jasper ap Owain ap Meredith. Jasper, the son of Owen, the son of Meredith. And Henry, correctly, should be Harry ap Edmund ap Owain. Harry, the son of Edmund, the son of Owen. So, you know, the Tudor name is almost just, it comes in just through simple mistake. You could argue Henry Tudor's surname, if we want to take his father's name as a surname, is Edmund, Henry Edmund. You know, it's quite a complex matter. And you know, in truth, they didn't call themselves the Tudors either. You know, Henry Tudor didn't go around going, "We are the Tudors. The Tudors now have the throne." You know, kings of England just call themselves, they are just a king. They're one in a continuous line of monarchy. Their enemies called them the Tudors. Richard III is on record as calling him Henry Tudor. And he's almost trying to draw attention to Henry being Welsh, because Henry being Welsh doesn't make him a good king of England in Richard's eyes. Richard tries to appeal to the good-hearted Englishman to fight off this foreign invasion. But yeah, it's quite an interesting one that we've settled on the Tudors, when that could just be some Clark's mistake back in the 1430s, getting very confused over this random Welsh language that he's suddenly presented with.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So he just doesn't understand the convention of names in Wales, and therefore just sort of plumps for the bit that makes sense to him, and it's stuck.
Yeah, in my book, I tried to draw together all the various references I found to Owen Tudor when he first moved to England, and there's copious mentions of him, but his name is butchered in every example. You know, he's called about six or seven different things in the same year because people just don't understand what they're doing with his name. And I think he himself perhaps must have eventually just settled on, you know what, I'm Owen Tudor, let's go with it. It happens today. People anglicise their names all the time. There was a very famous, you know, anglicisation movement in America. The one that just comes to mind is Steve Carell, because I'm just watching the US Office. You know, his name is Steve Carelli, but, you know, he's an Italian-American, but he calls himself Steve Carell. And that's across the board with that kind of thing. People still do it. People come to this country or America and they anglicise their names just to make it easier for them and everybody else. Whether that's right or wrong, etc., is a different debate. And I think Owen Tudor just settled on it. Why not? They're going to keep on wrecking his name anyway.
You may as well some part of it. That's fascinating, because that must be an interesting, well, an essential piece of knowledge, obviously, that you've taken into your research to be able to identify in the records that someone called Owen Meredith is the same man as Owen Tudor.
Well, that's where the historian has to be careful. You know, like, for example, I do know that after he gets arrested after his wife's death and he spends some time in prison, he eventually gets pardoned by Henry VI, his stepson, for daring to marry his mother in private. But Owen seems to just become part of the wider family household. And in 1450, when an English household is going across to France to get Margaret of Anjou to bring her back to become Henry VI's queen, part of that envoy includes a man called Owen Meredith. Now, as a historian, I don't know for a fact that that is Owen Tudor. So I have to write carefully and say there was an Owen Meredith part of this convoy. Perhaps this was the same Owen Tudor who was the stepfather of the king. It certainly makes sense that Owen Tudor would be part of that convoy. And we have another payment where Owen Tudor, as Owen Tudor, is paid for this voyage. So I'm very confident with context that this is the one and the same. But of course, I can't 100% be sure there could have just been two Owen Merediths. I think unlikely, but that's where it becomes tricky writing nonfiction. We have to make sure that you're covering yourself, you're covering your bases. You're not making up solid facts where perhaps you don't have the right to.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. So you spoke about, obviously, Henry is in Wales till he's 14, which I think probably, like you say, is maybe a surprise to people, because it does... I think Henry's story generally is a little bit skipped over anyway, and therefore it's shorthand, and shorthand always leads to misapprehensions, misunderstandings. But anyway, so he's 14 when he leaves Wales. Under what circumstances does he leave Wales?
With great fear and great terror, I would suggest. So it's 1471. The House of Lancaster has briefly come back to the throne in the middle of the Wars of the Roses. But then the Battle of Tewkesbury happens and the Yorkists annihilate Lancastrians. The Lancastrian leadership is wiped out, but the Tudors never made it to... They never made it to Tewkesbury. They were only at Chepstow, I don't know, what's that, 30 miles away before they got to the battle. They suddenly receive word, the battle's over, the Lancastrians are all being murdered, you're in trouble. Edward IV, the Yorkist king, knows that Henry Tudor is a nephew of Henry VI of Lancaster. And through his mother, Margaret Beaufort, has a slight claim to the Lancastrian throne. So Edward IV wants to destroy all Lancastrian opponents, and he wants to get his hands on Henry Tudor, probably to kill him quietly. He sends after a chap called Roger Vaughan to try and get hold of the Tudors at Chepstow. Somehow, Jasper Tudor finds out. He lays a trap. He executes Roger Vaughan. And that's actually payback, because 10 years earlier, Roger Vaughan had executed Owen Tudor. So Jasper gets a nice little bit of revenge on Roger Vaughan. And he takes his nephew, Henry Tudor, and flees through Wales. He knows he has to look after his 14-year-old nephew or he's going to be killed. They get to Pembroke, where they are besieged in the castle for 8 days before they manage to escape. Anyone who's been to Pembroke knows that if you go underneath the castle, there's a very big, you know, I don't know what it is. A cavern from the Bronze Age or whatever. Maybe they used that to escape, I don't know. But they manage to sneak out from the castle and they go to Tenby. Now, Tenby was Jasper's coastal fort. It was a walled city on the coast, which he'd spent 10 years building. So it's a very good thing that he did build this coast, this fort. And I think they spend a couple of months in Tenby hold up. Eventually, they know the Yorkists are going to get in and they're going to get hold of Henry. So they use a series of underground tunnels beneath Tenby. You can still go down them if you go to Boots the Pharmacy and ask nicely to see these underground tunnels. They go through the tunnels, they get into a small boat, and they head out to sea. Their plan is to go to France. Jasper and Henry are both related to the French king through their mother/grandmother, Catherine of Valois. They want to go to France, where they probably would spend the rest of their lives living quietly as part of the French household. But a storm blows them off course, and they end up in Brittany. Now, Brittany is an independent duchy back then. It's not a part of France, but it does fear French invasion. So Brittany's actually allied with England. So it's very complex. The Tudors turn up in a country that is allied with England and enemies to France. But what the Duke of Brittany does is, if he gives the Tudors to England, he has no bargaining chip to get more money from England, and France would just invade him. If he gives them to France, as France are requesting, then England are going to stop being the Bretons' friends. So Duke Francis decides just to hold on to the Tudors and play off France versus England. So the Tudors end up for the next 14 years just being pawns in this wider political game. England want them. France want them. The Bretons are sitting tight, getting more money from the English. You know, it's quite a frustrating position for the Tudors. And Henry would later call himself, having spent all of his life from childhood as a prisoner of others. Which I think says a lot about the man when he becomes king, that he would never do anyone's bidding. You know, once he becomes king, he very much becomes his own man, sure of his own mind, and very cautious of everybody else. So yeah, so he left Wales through those tunnels at 14 years old, looking over his shoulder, expecting at any minute capture and probably death. People call Henry Tudor a suspicious and paranoid king, like it's a negative trait. It's formed through childhood trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and when he... So he spends 14 years in Brittany as well then, did you say?
Yeah, so 12 years in Brittany before the Bretons finally reach an agreement with the new king, Richard III. They accept Richard's gold. They accept Richard's promise of more archers and men to help them in their French struggles. And they would turn over Henry Tudor. Now, Henry is warned, again, he got great spies in Richard III's council. I would possibly suggest someone with the surname Stanley, but we don't know that. Somehow Henry is warned he's about to be betrayed. So one night, he says he's going to go visit a friend. He puts on some riding gear and he heads out. A couple of miles into his journey, he gets off the road, puts on the disguise of a peasant and rides very hard for the French border. The Bretons realize he's escaped. They go after him. Henry, we're told, crosses into France with just 1 hour to spare. So this is 1484. He's already said he's going to become the next King of England, and he does this escape. So Henry does spend 12 years in total in Brittany before he escapes briefly to France in 1484, where he spends the next 2 years preparing his invasion of England. So it's 14 years in exile, 12 in Brittany, 2 in France.
Okay, so I want to come back to his invasion and his bid for the throne I want to come back to that. But first of all, what does he spend his time doing? 12 years, like that's through as well all his formative years basically spent in Brittany, becoming a teenager, a young man. So what does he spend his time doing?
God, who knows? I mean, he obviously isn't a soldier. He doesn't spend as much time practicing the martial arts, perhaps, because, you know, he's very famously not a soldier himself. He prefers others to take the lead. He certainly is an incredibly clever man. So I would suggest he probably spent a lot of his time reading, educating himself through conversations. He does seem to become a bit obsessed with King Arthur and the idea of the Arthurian legacy. Now, again, King Arthur is a Welsh hero through the Welsh languages. The Bretons are, of course, connected to Wales. We're told by linguists that Breton and Welsh, the languages, were mutually exclusive back then, intelligible. You could speak, you could get by in both. I mean, even I go to Brittany, I've been to Brittany a few times. The languages they're very similar but different. They're a lot more different these days because Welsh has been influenced by English and Breton has been influenced by French. But still, there's so much crossover with words and the Cornish as well. So I wonder whether Henry did become really enamoured with the King Arthur legend while in Brittany, which he had picked up probably during youth in Wales. He does become obsessed with a Breton saint called Armel. And Armel, he adopts as his personal saint, the man who, you know, the saint who he prays to for salvation and just help him. And Armel was actually a Welshman. He was a Welshman who crossed over to Brittany in the 6th or 7th century. So again, is Henry making this connection? He's in Brittany. There's a Breton saint who is from Wales like himself. Therefore, he's going to adopt him as his personal saint. Maybe Henry is spending his time learning, educating himself. I don't know, passing a rugby ball around. We have no insight into his day-to-day life. We just know that at various points during his exile, he's moved around from castle to castle. You know, he's been sheltered. There is one fascinating episode in 1476 when he's 19 years old. Edward IV this time is trying to get his hands on Henry, and he actually succeeds in bribing the Bretons to hand him over. So it's the first of the two occasions that Henry is threatened to be handed over. And this time he's actually given over to the English ambassadors and he's taken as far as St. Malo. Now, anyone who's ever been to Brittany will know you go from Portsmouth to St. Malo on the ferry today. Back then, it was still the easiest crossing route. St. Malo was the gateway out of Brittany into the south of England. Henry gets as close as being able to see the ships that were taking it back to England. If he gets on them ships, we would never have heard of the Tudor dynasty. We certainly wouldn't be sitting here today speaking about them. He would have been quietly dispatched. Henry faked an illness. A scuffle breaks out and he escapes. And he runs to a nearby church and he claims sanctuary. The Englishmen try to break into the church. The Breton people are not having it and they beat back the English. The English are forced to return empty-handed. Henry is taken back to the Breton court where they apologise to him for, as the quote goes, for having committed the sheep to the wolf. So, you know, we only have small insights into his time there, which again paint a period of fear, of uncertainty, of not being in control of his fate. But yeah, as to what he got up to on the day-to-day life, God knows.
So we don't know if he had any girlfriends, potential other Tudor babies.
So there is a lingering idea that he did have one bastard child, and this is a child called Roland de Velville. It's quite a complex case, but Velville effectively seems to have come to England with Henry in 1485. And we're told he's given so much honours that he must have been a bastard child. In particular, in 1510, he's given ownership of the ancestral Welsh Tudor lands in Anglesey. Why would someone give this random Breton the ancestral lands of the Tudor family in Anglesey if he wasn't one of their own? But I think this is... I think there's people inventing something here, inventing some links that aren't necessarily true. Velville does come to England with Henry Tudor, but he's not given any sort of rewards out of the ordinary. For example, in 1495, he jousts at the celebrations making... young Prince Henry, the future Henry VIII, he's allowed to joust in a tournament where normally only noblemen can joust. The only way a non-nobleman can joust is with the personal assent of the king. So people are suggesting, of course, the king is letting his son joust. But there are other people in the same joust who are of the same rank as Velville. So when you add in wider context again, it doesn't really add up to any special favour. Henry VIII, are we supposed to suggest that he's willing to grant lands and favour to what is actually an older half-brother? I don't buy that necessarily. The one thing, the key thing here, the final thing with Roland de Velville that has made a lot of people claim that he is a Tudor is his granddaughter... is a very, very famous person in Wales, and she is known as Catherine Tudor. She's also known as Catherine of Beraien. She's a very famous Welsh woman who married four times and was the richest Welsh woman in the Elizabethan age. I also think she actually has very close links to Elizabeth I. I think maybe she was in her household for a bit. But obviously she's called Catherine Tudor. Of course she's a Tudor. Not quite. She was a granddaughter of Roland Velville through her mother. But her father was a Welsh guy. And this Welsh guy's first name happened to be Tudor.
Yeah.
So as a kid, her name correctly in Welsh is, well, Catrin Ferch Tudor. Catherine, daughter of Tudor. It becomes contracted to Catherine Tudor. The Victorians have discovered a new Tudor, and on it goes. It's very, very unlikely that Roland de Velville is the son of Henry VII. I go into it in quite a lot of detail in my next book, so please buy that and go down my rabbit hole of research, because it's complex and I can't remember all of it. But again, it's just taken as fact today that Roland de Velville is a son of Henry VII. People claim descent from Henry VII all the time online through this connection. They do it through Henry VIII with the Carey children, and I'm like, I'm not quite sure about that.
That's fascinating, just that small bit. But so yes, yeah. Absolutely. Well, we definitely will be buying your book, I'm sure. So right then, let's go back to what you spoke about then, when Henry escapes to France. And he's already So when does he say about becoming King of England? How does that begin?
Well, first and foremost, it's not what Philippa Gregory and other fiction writers say, which is from birth, Margaret Beaufort is trying to make him king. I think we can completely get rid of that. That nonsense. The earliest we can say that Henry VII has any pretensions of becoming king is 1483, once Richard III is king. Up to that point, Margaret Beaufort's intention is to get Henry Tudor back to England and allow the Yorkists to let him live on as his rightful title of the Earl of Richmond. She is the great Beaufort heiress. She just wants to pass on her lands and inheritance to her son. That is clear as day. We know as late as 1482, she's still in discussions with Edward IV to let his son come home. Edward IV relents. He actually drafts up a pardon, saying Henry Tudor can come home, he can have his title of Earl of Richmond, he can have his inheritance, as long as he bends the knee to me, accepts me as the Yorkist king, and that will do. He might even be allowed to marry one of my daughters. But Edward IV dies. Richard III becomes king. The day before Richard III's coronation, Margaret Beaufort has a private meeting with Richard III. Now, officially, this is to discuss a family debt she is owed. Really, I believe she's asked Richard, by the way, can my son come home now? Your brother promised he could come home. Can he come home? Richard's gone, no. No chance. I've just taken the throne. I'm not going to let complications come back into England. Absolutely not. She's left that meeting and gone, oh, to hell with this. I'm going to try and take down this guy. And she initiates the conspiracy with Elizabeth Woodville to go against Richard III. Now, history's reading, obviously the Tudors' own reading of this after the fact, is that the plan was now set in motion for Henry Tudor to come back, invade, become King of England. And it's possible. It's possible from this moment, June 1483, Henry Tudor is now being put forward as the King of England. I don't quite buy that, because the other party in the conspiracies against Richard in 1483 is Margaret's cousin, the Duke of Buckingham. Now, the Duke of Buckingham is already the number two guy in the country. He decides to rebel against Richard III. He's not going to do that to just become the number 10th guy in the country under Henry Tudor and his supporters. The Duke of Buckingham is going for the crown in 1483. That's as clear as day. There's a reason it's called Buckingham's Rebellion. There's a reason that in 1484, in the Parliament, Richard III calls Buckingham the leader of the rebellion. And furthermore, Buckingham has a better Beaufort claim to the throne than Henry Tudor. So the last thing he's going to do, realistically, is step aside for some little cousin he doesn't know, who's younger than him, from abroad. But Buckingham gets killed on the 2nd of November, 1483. He gets executed. On the 3rd of November, 1483, the very next day, it's the first, earliest moment we have evidence that anyone called Henry Tudor a potential King of England. There's a group of rebels in Cornwall who claim that they are now going to set up an alternative king to Richard. That alternative king is Henry Tudor. And just 1 month later, on Christmas Day 1483, Henry Tudor very famously swears an oath to marry Elizabeth of York and unite the houses. So I would suggest the absolute earliest we have evidence of Henry Tudor being a potential King of England is the 3rd of November 1483, the day after Buckingham is killed. At a push, we can possibly accept June 1483 with Margaret Beaufort turning rebel. Before that, there is no evidence whatsoever that Henry Tudor ever had any intentions or claims or anything to the English throne. There were, however, in Wales, a series of bards who were prophesying that Henry Tudor was the Messiah who was getting ready to come back and save Wales. But that's different to being a King of England. The Welsh bards were expecting Henry Tudor, as the son of prophecy, to come back and push all the Saxon-blooded people and the Norman-blooded people into the sea and reclaim the island for the native Britons. So it's just a shame that there is this lingering idea that Henry Tudor was always put forward as the king from childhood, which has been spread by fiction, but it's also been spread by Shakespeare. You know, there was words back then that Henry Tudor met his uncle Henry VI as a child, and Henry VI turned to him and went, "This is the boy who will one day be king." Nonsense. It's nonsense. It simply didn't happen.
We have to always remember when Shakespeare was writing and for whom. And actually, I interviewed Nicola Tallis, who obviously did her wonderful biography of Margaret Beaufort. And we went into some detail in my interview, which if anyone wants to check it out, it was last November 2023, about that switch in Margaret's potential. That meeting with Richard and what that may have meant. So, but at what point does Henry himself then become part of this idea that he could be a potential king of England?
So, I mean, during the rebellions of 1483, he's certainly part of it, because he actually tries to invade England in 1483 in collusion with the Duke of Buckingham. Again, I think if he had invaded and the rebellion had been successful, Buckingham would have been king, and he would have been at his right-hand side, now Earl of Richmond, possibly promised the crown if Buckingham's lineage collapsed. But I still believe that in 1483, he was simply coming home to become the Earl of Richmond. Christmas Day 1483, he stands in front of an assembly of rebels. So when Buckingham's rebellion fails, about 400 Englishmen leave England, and they go straight across to Henry Tudor in Brittany, and they pledge their support to him. He stands in front of his men and he pledges an oath to them. "If you accept me as your king, I will marry Elizabeth of York." The rebels have got nothing else to lose, so they say, "Yes, we accept you as our king." And there is a chronicle that says they then treated him from that day forward as if he were already king. So Christmas Day 1483, definitely, regardless of what other people in the months leading up to that have been saying about him, we know that Christmas Day 1483, he himself pledges to be the rightful king of England. So I think that is the earliest we can say Henry. Obviously, in the lead up, you know, logic dictates that he must have been part of negotiations behind the scenes to be, "Yeah, I think I could be king. Let's go for it. I'm 26 years old, 27 at this point. I'm penniless. I'm a pawn of others. I'm a prisoner of others." I think he just lost his mind a little bit and thought, "What's the point? I'm stuck here in this never-ending life in Brittany. What's to lose? You know, what am I going to do? Spend the rest of my life just hanging around? I have no wife. I have no children. Probably have no children. What's the point of this? Waiting for the inevitable axe to fall on my head." You know, he's been handed over twice, nearly, by the Bretons. All it's going to take is one diplomatic treaty and he's gone. Duke Francis is his great protector in Brittany. And in fact, what I should have said is the two times he was handed over by the Bretons is because Duke Francis was ill at the time. So Henry's perhaps thinking, "Well, once Francis dies, they're just going to turn me over." So I think there's an element of Henry where, "Yeah, let's go. Let's have it.
Do your best."
Yeah. But yeah, Christmas Day is the absolute earliest we can see Henry Tudor had pretensions for the throne himself.
And what were the objections to Richard III being king? Why are these rebellions?
Because he killed the little princes, didn't he? I think it's myriad things. Obviously, a large section of English nobility were not going to support him because they did believe he'd killed the princes. Rightly or wrongly, they believed that. Richard couldn't disprove that fact. These rumours just took hold and people left the country. Now, of course, there's personal interest at play here. I'm sure many people initially were aghast that Richard had potentially killed the prince in the tower. But they also knew that Richard was his own king and he was cleaning house of Edward IV's old household. He was getting rid of all of Edward IV's supporters. you know, we can call him for ease, the Woodville faction. And he was bringing south his own supporters from the north. And he was clearly going on some sort of anti-corruption program. So self-interest is at play here. People don't want to lose their lands, their titles. They liked the status quo. So they're looking for alternatives. And Buckingham was the alternative. Then Buckingham died. They're being booted out of the country. They're being chased out of the country. They're going for Henry Tudor. He's the last hope for these people. But of course, they wanted a bit of a hand in the next regime, hence the alliance with Elizabeth of York. This is Henry's concession to these people to become their king. I think a lot of these rebels who supported Henry Tudor in 1483 and 1484, they thought they were getting a puppet on the throne. I mean, Henry Tudor, this random Welsh guy who had never run an estate, he was a political prisoner abroad. He's clearly going to be an idiot, a pliant, weak, malleable king. I bet you all of these people supporting him thought they were just going to get a pushover, a puppet king. And they forgot that they probably got the most resolute and hard-headed and stubborn king of England that ever was. They got a man who swore he would never be pushed over again once king. So it worked out well for Henry Tudor. Didn't quite work out so well for everyone else. But yeah, you know, Richard, if you're gonna be accused of killing princes, then you need to have a better defence than silence.
So you, before we, I want to come back to when Henry comes back that he lands in Wales. Anyway, I want to come back to that in a moment. But as soon as we've already touched on the Princess in the Tower, I've said in the introduction about you taking part in the Princess in the Tower, the New Evidence, I think the documentary was called, as pretty much the only questioning voice actually in that documentary. And obviously in that they talk about evidence or what they say is evidence that the Princess in the Tower in fact survived and thrived to some extent, but were enough to come back in turn to each try and claim their birthright. And I have done a little video when I was looking, just from a I don't have any, you know, dog in this race type of analysis. Hopefully I did a good job of the evidence that as it was presented. But it's probably a silly question, but where do you stand? Is there anything in what they've presented that questions the narrative, really, that the boys never left the tower anyway, regardless of what happened to them?
Philippa, why would you lower the tone of a really nice discussion by bringing up the princes in the tower?
I know you've spoken about this probably for more hours than any other element of your knowledge.
Look, it's a very complex discussion. I had so many thoughts, I started writing about it, and I ended up with 14,000 words as a rebuttal, which I'm not going to publish. I've decided not to publish it, but you know, I definitely had thoughts, and there's definitely holes in the idea that the case has been solved. I've always said, if I ever write a book on the Prince in the Tower, which is a big if, I would open it by saying, this book is not going to tell you definitively what happened. It's not possible to tell you what happened. We can theorize, we can speculate, but no one can say definitively what happened. And that goes for both sides. I can't say definitively Richard III killed the Prince of the Tower. I believe it based on the weight of evidence, context, etc., but I don't know that. So it's very dangerous to assume the case is closed and the boys have now been found to be alive through proof of life, which is exactly what is being said. And this is being taken for fact by Philippa Langley and by most, if not all, people who identify as Ricardians. There's too many holes in the story that can be counteracted. I'm going to have to try and remember what they are now, aren't I? The proof of life for allegedly Edward V, the eldest of the princes in the tower, it's a pike receipt for 400 pikes, obviously, in the name Edward V. And because it's in the name Edward V, this is taken as definitive proof of life that the boy who history is called Lambert Simnel was not pretending to be Edward the Earl of Warwick. It was pretending to be Edward V, the elder of the Prince of the Tower. Now, again, by itself, it's a fascinating document, but it doesn't prove categorically that that boy was Edward V. For example, coming back to our discussion, when Henry Tudor goes to France in 1484, the French instantly go, yes, we've got Henry Tudor. We're now going to send him across to England with an army to hassle Richard III. But we're going to call him Henry, the son of Henry VI of Lancaster. Henry Tudor was the nephew of Henry VI. He was not the son of Henry VI. But the French lie, and they try to go to the French Parliament to try and say he was the son of Henry VI to get him more money, more support, more credibility. The problem is, Henry VI and Henry Tudor were descended from Catherine of Valois. They were cousins to the French royalty. Everyone in France knew the lineage very well of the family. So straight away, the French Parliament went, we're not dumb. We know he's not the son of Henry VI. So very quickly, the French drop the act. They go, okay, fine. We'll start just calling him the rightful King of England. Is something similar happening in Burgundy in the 1487? Has somebody decided we're going to call this little boy we have, Lambert Simnel, let's call him Edward V, because it gives him more credibility. It gives him more right to get money from people. Before people quickly point out, well, the boy we've got is 10 years old. The prince in the tower would be 16 years old at this point. It doesn't really make much sense, and I don't think the English would buy it. Oh, okay. Let's just call him Edward, Earl of Warwick from now on. Has something as simple as that happened? Mm-hmm. It could be. What I find very funny about this is that this one document is taken in the book and taken by people who perhaps don't, I'm being accused of not having an open mind, which I find ironic, because I would suggest in this case, in the book itself, it is mentioned numerous times that there are copious documents in the Burgundian archives that keep on mentioning that the boy in 1487 was, quote, the son of Clarence or the Count of Warwick, i.e. Edward of Warwick, who history has told us is who the boy was pretending to be. So why are we taking one document which is fascinating but disregarding the other 10 or 12 documents that contradict it? If there's a contradiction, it's not, complete evidence, is it? There has to be a discussion about it. It's fascinating that they have this document about Edward V, but it's not in itself conclusive proof of life. It doesn't answer the most simple answer in all of this, is that when Henry VII got wind of this conspiracy taking place in England, the Lambert Simnel conspiracy, why did he have the real Warwick paraded through London? Everyone knew that this boy was pretending to be Warwick. So I think it's a fascinating document, but not proof of life. God, the Perkin Warbeck one. So the Perkin Warbeck witness statement, for example, it is what they've called it. It's a witness statement by someone claiming to be Richard, Duke of York. I am Richard, Duke of York. I escaped the tower this way. I spent this time in France. Then I went to Burgundy. And I'm the rightful King of England. My name is Richard, Duke of York. Well, if you're Perkin Warbeck pretending to be the Duke of York, you're not going to sign a letter, Richard, Duke of York, a.k.a. Perkin. So just the fact you have a witness statement in itself is not conclusive. Who wrote it? When was it written? Why was it written? What are they intending to do? But it's also not unique. We already knew this. Anyone who read my book, Henry VII and the Tudor Pretenders, I didn't know about this specific witness document, but there was another witness statement written at the same time in the same principle. Richard, I am Richard, Duke of England. I escaped the Tower of London. We already knew about these witness statements. What I do find fascinating is they have different information in what happened to the elder of the Prince in the Tower. In the first witness statement, the one we always knew, Perkin Warbeck, I'm going to call him, not Richard Duke of York. Perkin Warbeck says, my elder brother, Edward V, was miserably put to death. In the second witness statement, he now says, my elder brother escaped the Tower of London with me and we were separated. So why are there two witness statements written with different information? What's happening behind the scenes? I don't know. I think the point is you could pick holes in these documents all day long, which just simply by its nature means it's not conclusive. And it's nothing to do with having a closed mind and wanting to keep the old Tudor narrative on. I obviously have more of a dog in the fight in one respect in that this is my period of study, but I don't actually care what the upshot is. If there is conclusive, completely conclusive evidence that the Prince of the Tower survived or that Henry VII killed them, it doesn't really change anything in my day-to-day life. I'm not trying to revitalize the reputation of somebody, or I don't have a campaign here. I have an interest. It's like, you know, the book and the project, etc. It has an end goal, which is to absolve Richard III. That's what the goal is working towards. If you show me the Henry VII murdered the Prince in the Tower, fine. He murdered the Prince in the Tower. Okay. I mean, it happened. I don't know what else you want me to say about that kind of idea. There's a lot of emotional energy being wasted on this. And you can argue, you know, people always say, oh, you sound very passionate and emotive. I think it's probably more just anger and tiredness for me, not passion.
I think you're only get emotional about the process and the lack of questioning around these particular documents is actually what came across as someone who was coming into it quite independently. From my point of view, is like, well, but you're just literally going to take this document and take it as that everything in there was written down and is absolutely the truth, and there's no agenda behind why it's written, or just even if there's no agenda, that it was absolutely the truth. As if we wrote down something on paper now and it's the only piece of paper that exists in 500 years' time, and we could have written whatever we like on it, but it's going to be taken as absolute truth. It's just, it doesn't seem like a robust way of inquiring and researching.
And for me, we've all watched true crime documentaries, and it's always very famously the person with the longest alibi, the one with the crocodile tears, you know, the one who's going to incredible lengths to cover their tracks. As opposed to the person who goes, oh, no, I don't know where I was on that night 3 weeks ago. I don't know where I was last night, you know. But if I suddenly was putting together, at 10:37, I was driving down this street, and at 10:41, I was on the... If you're putting together such a prolonged, lengthy alibi, it's almost like you're trying to cover up something. It's not natural behavior. And this witness statement is incredibly detailed for its time. Mm-hmm. But there's also so many parts of it that simply don't make any sense. One of it is that they claim that Perkin Warbeck Richard Duke of York left the Tower of London and went across immediately to France, and then spent some time in France, including in Paris. Wait, stop. England and France at this time, during Richard III's reign, are engaged in what's becoming a war. Why is Richard III allowing a dynastic threat to himself to cross over to France, his enemy? That in itself is an insane breach of a state security, for one. Why does this letter claim that they hung around in Paris until they were noticed by some English folk and then had to leave? Guess who was in Paris at the same time? Henry Tudor. Guess who was with Henry Tudor at this time? The Woodville faction. Are we really supposed to believe the Woodville faction, who by this point have adopted Henry Tudor through his promise to marry Elizabeth of York, that they are going to discover that in many cases they are nephew, they are blood, Edward V, is in Paris, and they're not going to go, well, forget about Henry Tudor, let's get the real king back on his throne? That doesn't make any sense. I would suggest that the whole Perkin Warbeck mission statement mentions France because the conspiracy started in France. I believe the conspiracy always was a French-backed conspiracy to get at Henry Tudor. Because Henry Tudor, when he becomes king, he becomes an enemy of France. Even though France made him king, he becomes an enemy of France. He picks the side of Brittany during Brittany's war with France. So France and England go to war. The French actually call Henry Tudor ungrateful for this. And at the same time, suddenly, Perkin Warbeck appears. 4 years later, when Henry Tudor reaches an agreement with France, a treaty, and he gains support from them that they would never support Perkin Warbeck again, the French start telling everybody that Perkin Warbeck was a fraud. They send envoys to Spain. They send envoys to Scotland saying Perkin Warbeck was a fraud. I think because they've simply given up on the conspiracy. But, you know, what do I know?
All of this is so fascinating. I do want to finish off, though, by going back to Wales for a little while. Because when Henry comes back in 1485, he decides to land in Wales. So can you please tell me why then and why and where did he land and why?
So, I mean, Henry Tudor lands at a place called Mill Bay. Mill Bay is a small cove or inlet on the Pembrokeshire Peninsula. It's near the nearest village is a place called Dale. You basically drive to Pembroke, Henry's birthplace, and keep on going. Beautiful part of the land. I love it. I strongly suggest people spend a walking weekend down there and almost retrace the footsteps. Wales is a good place to land for Henry. He has been sending letters to Wales in the previous few months to all of his old kinsmen, to many notable Welshmen, asking them for their support. Because he knows in what I think the quote is, miserable servitude you Welsh have long been kept in. He's playing on his personal connections. He's playing on his personal knowledge. Come on, you Welsh, support me and I will help you against the English. That's what he's doing. It's also possible he's reached an agreement with a chap called Rhys ap Thomas. Rhys ap Thomas is a very distant cousin of the Tudors and the most powerful Welshman of his day. If he can secure Rhys' support, he basically gets a free landing and he can start marching up through Wales. It also makes logical sense. In 1483, when he tried to invade England as part of Buckingham's Rebellion, he tried to land in Dorset, and he got close enough to the beach to see men on the beach, and his men were saying, "Come on, come and land, Henry. Where are your supporters?" They were not his supporters. They were Richard III's men. Something in Henry's mindset realized something's going on here, and he turned and returned to Brittany. So he's obviously already had one crack at England and decided, I'm not quite sure about this. I'd rather go home. And that's what he does. He goes home. It's Pembrokeshire. It's where he's from. We are told that when he lands on the soil, the first time he's been on Welsh soil in 14 years, he falls to the ground and he says, "Judge me, God, and fight my cause." You know, he's kissing the Welsh soil like I do every time I go home. And again, it makes sense. He marches up through North Wales. He's protected on every part by mountains. It just gives him some time to get an army going because he doesn't invade with a great army. He invades with about 3,000 to 4,000 men, mainly French. He's mainly French. The hardcore, 300, 400 English rebels he has with him and a few Scots. He starts marching through Wales. He brandishes his personal banner, the Red Dragon of Cadwallader. Every Welshman knows this. I mean, every Welshman today loves the dragon. I've got the dragon tattoo on my arm, just like most Welsh people of my generation. He's raised that flag, and people are going to be taken by it. They are going to march towards it, and they do. Again, for some reason, history tells us Henry had no support in Wales. I don't know where this comes from. The evidence is plainly untrue. He gathers thousands of men by the time he reaches the English border, and it's then that he starts to get defections on the English side. He gets Gilbert Talbot, he gets the Stanleys. So by the time Henry gets to Bosworth, he has a decent army. not as big as Richard's, but a decent army. And that's only because it is galvanized by Welsh recruits, most notably Rhysab Thomas, who brings thousands of men to him on a Welsh mountain in mid-Wales. So it's emotional, it's psychological, it's logical that he lands in Wales. Gives him enough breathing time to get his act together. And just on a final point, it's often mentioned from certain people that Henry Tudor was a coward who hid at Bosworth. Cowards don't march, don't cross a seven-day journey across sea, land in Wales, march 200 miles to the mountains to go to a battle where they're probably going to lose. Cowards don't do that. And I also suggest, far from his dour personality that's come down through the centuries, what a charismatic man he must have been to hold together this motley crew through these really hard and punishing times on this journey, to hold together, not only hold together the army, but to actually bring fresh recruits. Something about him must have appealed to people when he looked in their eyes and spoke to them to get them to come along on this, well, kamikaze mission, really.
Mm. And when he became king, did he repay the Welsh in any way? Did he ever go back to Wales?
So again, another misconception is that he never went back. Well, we have two instances where he did go to Wales. One was to Holt in North Wales, when he went to personally inspect the Stanley lands in 1495. And secondly, in 1502, just after his son had died, Prince Arthur, he joins his wife, Elizabeth of York, on a Western Progress, and they go to Raglan Castle. Now, Raglan at this time was in the hands of Elizabeth's either sister or cousin. So she's gone to visit family. He's gone with her. Raglan was where he grew up. He spent 10 years growing up at Raglan. He's gone home. I find that quite a nice journey for two grief-stricken parents. And of course, it's the final journey Henry would take with Elizabeth, because she would shortly die herself. But this lack of visiting Wales has again been taken by Welsh and English historians as evidence that Henry didn't care about Wales. I would suggest the opposite is true. Henry had a lot of problems in England during this time. He had Cornish rebellions, he had issues in the north. He had complete plots, conspiracies taking place throughout his kingdom. Wales was secure. Wales was the only secure part of his realm. He didn't need to go back. He'd handed over complete control of Wales to two Welshmen, his uncle Jasper Tudor and his ally, Rhysab Thomas. They had Wales completely secure. He simply didn't need to go home. When we look at Henry's relationship with Welsh, we need to consider a few things. He lavishly rewarded Welshmen. He's the first king of England that had rewarded Welshmen, in the scope that he did. The Welsh had always been viewed very negatively by English kings. And of course they would. We were the most rebellious part of English kings' kingdoms. You know, we'd spent 300-400 years fighting. I say we, I wasn't. fighting the English kings. So no English king or English nobility ever trusted the Welsh. Henry did. He rewards two of his uncles. People never mention these uncles he still has. We know about Jasper Tudor, but he had another uncle called David Owen. David Owen was the illegitimate son of Owen Tudor. And do we notice that surname there? David Owen. David Ap Owen. So he's not given the Tudor name. He's given the Owen name, actually correctly in the Welsh form. So David Owen became one of Henry's closest friends, because even though he was his uncle, David Owen was actually 2 years younger than Henry. He becomes his chief carver. There's another uncle that people don't often mention about or even know about, is another Owen Tudor. This Owen Tudor is the younger brother of Jasper Tudor, and he had not grown up with the rest of the family as a child. When he was born in the 1430s, he had been given over to Westminster Abbey to be raised as a monk. And he was still alive when Henry Tudor becomes king. And it's a really touching incident where in 1502, this Owen Tudor monk dies, and Henry Tudor pays for his funeral. and also has the bells of Westminster rung for his uncle. I think that's fascinating. Imagine being this monk. You've lived through the Wars of the Roses. You reached your middle age. And suddenly some random nephew you've never known becomes king. And suddenly you're probably the most well-liked monk in Westminster. Again, a fascinating story. So many Welshmen flocked to London and Henry Tudor that they even have a pub on Fleet Street called The Welshman, which unfortunately is no longer around. And there's so many Welshmen in London that Henry starts funding St. David's Day. He's the first king of England that gives money to his men for St. David's Day feasts. You know, we suddenly have a big brain drain from Wales. You know, there's still a huge Welsh community in London today, and it all starts with Henry Tudor becoming king. He uses the Red Dragon as his private personal emblem. He names his son Arthur. He commissions a background on his Welsh ancestry. He regularly makes payments for Welsh mead to be brought to him from Wales. Probably grew to like it as a child. He makes payments to Welsh harpists. He even makes a payment for the funeral of one Welsh harpist. Again, a king, we're told, is a miser. A king, we're told, is Ebenezer Scrooge, consistently paying out for his Welsh background. And of course, as the royal saint during this time, he makes it Saint Armel, this Welsh Breton saint of his. There is so much evidence of Henry's passion for his Welsh background. And I think one of the most telling things from Wales's point of view is this country that for 300-400 years had consistently risen up in rebellions is the only part of the Tudor realm that does not rebel throughout the 118 years on the throne. How many northern rebellions are there during Henry VIII, Elizabeth I's reign? How many East Anglian rebellions? How many Cornish rebellions? Lincolnshire rebellions? Wales never rebels. And that's because Wales took the Tudors to heart. And I believe at least the first Tudor took Wales to heart as well.
So much. We haven't got time today. And it would, but I'm actually really fascinated by Owen Tudor, the uncle. If he's at Westminster Abbey, then he was there during, presumably, Elizabeth. I'm trying to think now, my timings. Elizabeth Woodville Sanctuary?
I had never thought of that. Maybe we've got a new conspirator during this period. Maybe he was a man able to get word in and get word out. I got goosebumps. I'd literally never ever thought about that before.
We shall talk more about that, I'm sure. So, okay, well, I want to finish up this main part of the interview before we go on to some questions that my patrons have put forward to you. Now, you've written about the Tudors, and the other thing you write about is pubs. And so I think we may be soulmates in some way, because the Tudors and pubs are also two of my favourite favourite topics. And you post quite often on your social media about where you are and what beer you're drinking, which is also, I find, probably equally fascinating. So I just want to see how alike we are in our beverage tastes. So, ale or lager?
The problem is it's always different tastes for different days, but I would say...
Do you have different weather for different...
Yeah, you know, a lager is a nice summer or post-workout drink. Ales are...
Post-workout, brilliant.
Ales are a winter drink. Generally, I would go for a hazy pale ale or, you know, some sort of craft beer. But even then, if I've had a big night on those, I'm off them for a week. I like milk stouts. I'm a very variable drinker, but ale or lager, if it did come down to that one choice, it would be ale.
Excellent. Good.
There's more taste to ale than a lager. Is a straight up one off, you know, thirst quencher. That's it.
Lager reminds me of being on holiday because you can't get ale in hot places.
Yeah.
And that's the only time I enjoy it. I'm an ale girl. Okay, so I think I know the answer to your next question, to this next question. Hobgoblin or Brewdog?
Just based on the company's listed, Hobgoblin.
Did you ever see their advert? And I'm desperate to get this poster, and it's out of print and I can't get it. There's the Hobgoblin. For anyone who doesn't know, Hobgoblin is a proper ale, and Brewdog is like more like the IPAs, like hazy beers. And Hobgoblin ran this poster campaign. What's the matter, Lager Boy? Scared of tasting something? Just, if anyone ever sees that poster come up, please let me know.
They sell t-shirts of it, I'm sure. I've seen them before.
Yeah. I need it. I need to find a Google search didn't come up with anything. So, and pints or bottles?
Pints. Pints in a pub, bottles at home, I think is the general split.
I love it. Okay. Cool. So there's I've got a couple of new questions, if I may, that I'm going to put to all new guests from now on. You're the first, so you are the guinea pig. And the first one is which period of history outside of that for which you're known, so outside of the sort of Tudors and the 15th to 16th century that you're known for, which period are you most interested in? Sort of, is there one that you read for leisure?
Yeah, I think really oddly, it's the 1960s, and more specifically, kind of like the Black Civil Rights era in America. And that started through my absolute obsession with Muhammad Ali. And once you read something like Muhammad Ali, you need to read Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, you read around it. And separate to that, I'm also, one of my first obsessions was the American Mafia. So it's, and then, you know, by the 1960s, they were essentially running America. So, yeah, it's probably all of these interests I have do all seem to combine in this one decade, in this one area. Now, I wouldn't say I wouldn't pick the 1960s America by itself, but it's just all of my interests do seem to converge in that one decade. So probably let's go with that.
Excellent. And okay, this is maybe too big a question. So see if we can answer it. This is why you're a guinea pig. What do you think we can learn from history? What would be one, like, why do we look at history? What's the point?
Oh, I mean, that is a complex question, isn't it? I suppose from history, first of all, is the topic. We can learn, you know, the civil art of debate, how to weigh up your sources, questioning the narrative, developing analytical skills, and so on. So we can learn that from the topic itself, and then we can extend that to our actual life. You know, if you can learn the civil art of debate in a historical discussion, why can't you extend that to your personal life, to modern political discussions? If you can learn how to weigh up sources and, you know, develop those skills that you need to analyze material, well, again, apply that to your modern life. If you're being told something by various media sources, don't just believe it at face value. Try and delve a bit deeper to try and get more to the heart of the issue. And again, I suppose people today are just people, and people in the past were just people. You know, no one was two-dimensional. Richard III was not a monster. Henry VII was not a dour accountant-esque king. They would have had good days, bad days, you know. They would have had mood swings. So too are people today. So perhaps, I don't know, cut everyone a bit of slack. If we can cut historical figures slack, cut people today slack, and vice versa.
Love it. Completely agree. Okay, so before we move on to the questions from our patrons, which I know we've got some in there around Henry's relationship with his wife, whether or not he liked his son Henry. So we're going to get into that in shortly. But before we do, can you tell people where they can find you online? Obviously, let's hear about your new book as well.
Yeah, obviously, type my name into any decent search engine, Nathan Amin, and you'll come up with a list of my social medias, Nathan Amin Instagram, Nathan Amin Twitter, Nathan Amin Facebook, and increasingly Nathan Amin Substack. I'm trying to get my Substack to grow, which is where I'm going to start publishing more long form material. So please give me a follow there. And also pick up my new book out in the summer, Son of Prophecy, The Rise of Henry Tudor. It's a biography basically about Owen Tudor, Jasper Tudor, and Henry Tudor's entire journey to the moment he becomes king.
Fantastic. Really looking forward to that. We'll have to get you back on after that comes out as well, if you're up for it.
Absolutely. As I keep on saying, it's the story of the Tudors, but not as you all know it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Margaret Beaufort was not the power behind the throne. He knew if he died and he left behind a child heir, that child heir was going to get destroyed.
Explain the origin of the Beaufort name.
History's always told us that it's because they were born in a castle called Beaufort in France. And it's nonsense.